like to move through now to Dr. Archer. If you could note down those questions, we'll get to question time soon.
Okay, good morning, everyone. So my name is Rosalind Archer. I'm with the University of Auckland, and I'm what's called a reservoir engineer. So once reservoirs have been discovered using the techniques that Greg and Richard have talked about, my mandate is figuring out how to get the oil and gas out of those reservoirs. So Greg and Richard have both done a great job of giving you some background about the kind of formations where we discover oil and gas. They're porous rock formations, so they're essentially sponge-like formations at depth. And these formations need to be capped off by an impermeable layer referred to as a source rock. So I'll skip through that one. Why is getting oil and gas out of these formations something that's difficult to do, something that's expensive to do? Partly it's because these formations are large in extent aerially, so they're several kilometres across in a map view, and they're also deep below the Earth's surface. They're at high pressure and high temperatures, so I've indicated that you may be talking about pressures of up to 15,000 pounds per square inch and temperatures on the order of 200 degrees C. So any instrumentation you send down there is getting squashed and cooked. Hence, it costs a lot of money to do. These pore spaces in the rock are occupied both by oil, gas, and water. So people like me look at how all three of those fluids move around and how we can preferentially extract oil or gas, but not the water, because the water that's found in an oil reservoir isn't normally an attractive resource. It's normally contaminated by all sorts of naturally occurring things that we don't necessarily want to bring to surface. One of the other challenges, of course, is the expense. An exploration well could cost you easily $100 million US dollars, easily. So wells are kind of like needles in the haystack. We have this vast area to explore, and wells are the only place we can get what I call hard data, direct data, actual physical measurements of what's going on in the subsurface. Anything we do without drilling a well is what's called an indirect measurement. So we're sending sound waves or vibrations through seismic experiments. We're doing other kind of remote sensing work and trying to infer the structure of the Earth from those. And that's a much harder problem, but much cheaper to do than drilling a well. And then one thing that many people may not realise is that once we discover a reservoir, it may have hopefully an enormous quantity of oil in it, but we can't recover every last drop. The recovery factor that we can typically access may be only on the order of 30%. So we actually leave a huge amount of oil behind quite frequently. So in many ways, the largest resource of oil out there that we know about is oil that's already in reservoirs but can't be produced from those reservoirs because of technological issues, economic issues. If the oil price was $300 a barrel, I could probably go and produce more oil, or companies could go and produce more oil, but there are constraints, which mean we leave a lot of oil behind in reservoirs. My next slide is just a listing of some of the key reservoirs in New Zealand, but in the interest of time, I won't discuss this too much. One thing to keep in mind about the operation of reservoirs is that they're almost always done by joint ventures. So as has been mentioned, companies like to share the risk in these operations. If you're sharing risk between many companies, two or more, then that involves a joint venture agreement, which partners must agree on operating practices, or in cases where there are disagreements, that leads to litigation. So, for example, there is a reasonably high-profile case in front of the High Court that's pending at the moment on the order of a $300 million lawsuit between three major energy companies. Some of the issues that reservoir engineers deal with that are particular to a lot of New Zealand reservoirs, they're definitely things that happen other places, but they do make some of New Zealand operations a little more challenging, is that some of our oil fields produce a waxy crude. So the image at the top is a pipe that has been plugged up by wax that has been deposited out of the oil as it's produced. So this requires extra chemical treatments or extra heating to manage those kind of fields. If we're not managing problems like that, then the amount of oil we could recover from one of those waxy reservoirs decreases. The blue and green figure in the middle is a seismic monitoring image from Shell, from Maui, where we're looking at how water has invaded into a gas zone. So water is in blue, gas is in green, and the numbering scheme keeps track of the interface between water and gas at different points in time. So this is a measurement of how much water has invaded into the gas zone and diminished productivity to gas. That's fantastic information for reservoir engineers to have. Really helps them manage the reservoirs better, but is very expensive to acquire. At Kapuni, one of the off-operating issues that they face is that the gas they produce naturally is very high in CO2. So all the natural gas that comes out of Kapuni is very corrosive for the plant, needs CO2 to be stripped out of the production stream before that gas can be sold. Some of the more sort of frontier things about where I think we're going in terms of reservoir engineering are using the technology that is normally used to extract oil and gas for CO2 sequestration. So taking CO2, for example, in the graphic with a power station that is capturing CO2 that would otherwise be vented to atmosphere, so a thermal power station, grabbing that CO2, injecting it into a depleted oil and gas reservoir. So once I've removed oil, gas, and maybe water from a reservoir, I have space available in that porous structure. So I can inject CO2 and I can keep it there, ideally. Oil and gas reservoirs are very attractive for that because there's been all this money spent on the geology and the geophysics to really understand those rock structures and to give us confidence that that CO2 will stay there. One of the points that Richard Cook hinted at is gas hydrates. Gas hydrates in the lower graphic, that's a structure that chemically looks like ice, but it's an ice where I have a cage around a methane molecule and it's ice that burns. These are formations that New Zealand could have absolutely world-class resources of. They're deposited over large areas of our seabed or shallow beneath the ocean. But figuring out how to produce these things appropriately is still a very open question. So all of our organisations, in fact, are involved in some questions trying to evaluate what kind of resources could mean for New Zealand. Nowhere in the world is producing these resources commercially. The other resource that I think oil and gas people are going to become more involved in is cobalt and methane. So New Zealand has large resources of coal, but some of that coal is in structures where there is methane stored inside the coal seams. So there is work being done in the Huntly area looking at extracting the methane and leaving the coal behind, so producing the methane as a resource, potentially a lot more potential for that in the South Island. And then my last sort of technical slide looking ahead in terms of where the industry's going. Overseas, there's a huge amount of interest in producing low permeability systems. So these are systems where natural gas doesn't flow very readily, but it will flow. So producing from rocks that are essentially shales, massive investments in that in the US, and I think that's interest that could come to New Zealand. Drilling in deeper and deeper water, given some of the seismic acquisition that's been done by Crown Minerals to attract explorers to do that. On the reservoir engineering side, where we're going is into a world of artificial intelligence where wells and reservoirs will become smart. They will have downhole monitoring equipment where they are constantly recording pressures and temperatures inside well bores and making decisions in an automated kind of a way to try and optimize production. And then the last bullet is some of the basin targets where we may be ultimately producing oil and gas from in the future. So I've just left my contact details on the last slide, but I will wrap it up there.
Thank you very much, Rosalind. I'll open it up for questions now. If you could please introduce yourself before you ask your question, we'd appreciate it.
Kent Atkinson from NZPA.
Go ahead, Kent.
I had a question, probably best for Dr. Archer. One of New Zealand's biggest coal seam gas explorers is seeking prospecting rights over 2,000 square kilometres in the Waikato. Mm-hmm. It wants to burn the coal underground to produce gas that can be piped to Auckland. There's likely to be up to 2 billion tonnes of coal there. what environmental risks does that pose in terms of subsidence, water pollution, out-of-control fires? Because I don't think we've had this kind of underground refining of gas from coal previously.
That's true. I don't think it has been done before. I'm not personally familiar with the project well enough to be able to comment, but I have a colleague who would be. So perhaps if you get in touch with me offline, I can get the two of you talking.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
I had another question. I'm not sure who would be best for it. Perhaps Dr. Cook. Still, Michael Studdinger from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory suggested a 3 kilometre high plateau the size of France collapsed and sank south of New Zealand about 105 million years ago. If he's correct, what would be the potential implications for petroleum geology and obviously the evolution of the flora and fauna there, considering New Zealand was right next to this Ross Sea area during the Cretaceous times when the sedimentary basins were being laid down, where everybody's looking for their petroleum source rocks at the moment?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch the beginning of that question about
Michael Studdinger at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University suggested late in 2007 that there had been a 3 kilometre high plateau the size of France south of New Zealand, essentially between New Zealand and what's now the Transantarctic Mountains. He says that appears that that collapsed and sank about 105 million years ago. I'm wondering what the potential implications of that would be for the petroleum geology, or rather the evolution of the flora and fauna in the area and the subsequent petroleum geology, because it would have a bearing on whether New Zealand should be, or oil explorers should be looking towards the Ross Sea for sedimentary basins with petroleum source rocks in them.
Yes, certainly. The Ross Sea is another basin that, there are three basins in the Ross Sea, very similar to the basins off the in the Campbell Plateau of New Zealand. And that area was geologically developing at the same time. The whole area was part of Gondwana. The Campbell Plateau butted right into the Ross Sea. And so those basins would be very similar to the Great South and the other basins around on the Campbell Plateau, the Pukaki and Campbell basins that are there. And so the geology is very similar to those. I originally did a paper comparing those way back in the mid-1980s, and there is a great similarity to the geology of the two regions. We have also seen that there have been the odd encounter with oil seeps down in the Antarctic area in the Ross Sea, and so there is certainly potential down there. But of course, the oil companies at the moment are completely precluded under the Antarctic Treaty from doing any work there. And what has been done has only come from general scientific tectonics and understanding of the movements of the plates and things. That's really the only work that's been done down there to date.
But it's fair to say that New Zealand, in making its UNCLOS claim for the extension of the seabed on the continental shelf, kept open the option to, at some later stage, make a claim for the Ross dependency.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't really say anything about that. I wasn't party to any of those negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right, do we have a question from Annabelle, Ruth, or another of the unnamed people dialed in?
Yeah, it's Annabelle Mackley here from Good Magazine. I've got a question. I think it was Rosalind who said that these oil deposits could be up to 6 kilometres below the Earth's surface. I was wondering, the problem with the Deepwater Horizon spill seems to be that they're drilling at such depths that when the accident happened, it was beyond their technical ability to fix it. I'm not sure what depth that was at, but how does it compare to the depths we're looking at in New Zealand?
Oh, okay, yeah. So the issue in the Gulf of Mexico isn't so much the depth of the actual reservoir. it's the depth of the water that they're drilling in. So they're drilling in very deep water. And so they're drilling in about, you've got a mile of water on top of you before you get to the rock. And it's really that mile of water in the way that is constraining your options in terms of what you can do to mitigate that spill. So I think what's happened in the Gulf is perhaps going to slightly put the brakes on drilling in ultra-deep water. Some of the, for instance, the Rokumaura block, and Richard may also want to comment on, covers a wide range of water depth. So what's being proposed in New Zealand is not necessarily implying that we will be drilling in water anywhere near that depth. But, yes, the further off we go off our coastline, the deeper water we get into and the more difficult spill remediation would be to deal with if there's a well blowout.
If I could just add in there, the exploration around New Zealand in the next at least 18 months will not step out into any of the really deep water. We have seen exploration in deep water around New Zealand, as I said, right back in the 1970s, 1,500 metres of water, which is 4,500 feet of water, was actually drilled in the Great South Basin. Back as far as 1976. And then, yes, they were really pushing technologies. But one of the key things at the moment is we've got to know what happened and why the oil spill occurred and or why the rig exploded in the US before it can be sort of worked through as to how this would be, whether that was a human error issue on the drill floor or whether that was a mechanical problem with the actual equipment on the seafloor. So there's a lot of issues that have got to be sorted before that. And New Zealand's maritime groups, maritime or Maritime New Zealand, sorry, they have people over there looking at the what has gone on and trying to understand it. So that's an important response that we'll get back fairly quickly.
So what depths of water are we dealing with now, the current exploration in the near future?
Okay, this year's drilling mostly has been in about 100 metres of water. I think we went up as far as 300 metres of water with Hoki, but mostly it's all wouldn't class as deep water. But once you step off the shelf, out into Rokuma, out into the deep water Taranaki, out into the Reanga basins, Great South Basin, you're into the deeper water, probably 1,000 metres plus.
Okay, thanks.
And Rosalind, just to clarify, what would you consider ultra deep? Is the rough threshold for that?
I would say 1,500 metres.
Yeah.
I had to pick a number.
Yep.
Ken Hackinson, can I just ask on that on the issue of the Great South Basin, before Tauhara 1 was accidentally sealed off, it was said to have bled thick dark oil. I was wondering to what extent that locality is likely to be a prime target in drilling in the Great South Basin. And similarly, the Kawa 1A hole were tested for gas but was judged sub-commercial. I was wondering whether improved technologies, such as magnet fracturing technologies and other extraction technologies, may now make that commercial on what we know of that hole.
Right, if I could take that, Richard Richard Cook. Tauhara 1, that was an accidental flash set of cement while they were trying to case the hole and never got to test it. It certainly did have oil coming onto the, as they were drilling, onto with coming up with the cuttings. But the actual size and volume of that was never able to be tested because of the flash set of the, I think it was 3,000 feet or 1,000 metres of cement flash set in the hole. So they would have had to basically redrill that well. Yes, it could well be a target, but I think our understanding of the seismic, the companies that are now exploring that area, would be looking at totally new information that could supersede and maybe find a better location than just Aurora. As far as Kawau was concerned, yes, that was tested. It came up to a volume that was understood from the petroleum engineering. It was understood to be about half the size of the Kapuni field. And if you and it was gas condensate, primarily gas, and so I would think that you'd be very lucky to get that into a commercial sense offshore.